Well, I think there had. I can remember a sense of great sacrifice, purpose. I can remember rose petals and a sleepy, slow death whose worst pain was knowledge that it was irreversible and would take its time, but not be changed. I don't know why I said majesty. What did Cyrus say of me to you? Not enough, I don't think. But according to this tablet, you cannot be destroyed. If the bones are destroyed, then you are loosed upon the world to take vengeance on everything living like a pestilence. Despair descended on me. It descended on me utterly, a despair that would have been impossible for the spirit I had been only a few hours ago. When I wandered upwards towards those with joyous faces, when I saw the gleam of light, I hadn't known despair. I hadn't known it any more than a child being turned away from a plate of sweets. Now I knew. "I want to die," I whispered. "I want to truly die as I was supposed to die, before they did this to me, misguided fools that they were, before they tried this fearsome magic. Ah, idiots! Oh, God!" "Die?" he asked, "and wander among the stupid dead? Become a demon growling among other spirits? Become a great foul enemy of all that is good, a bringer of death and torment?" "No, just die. Die as if in my mother's arms. Die as if to lie in my mother earth. And if I become light, and if there is heaven, so be it. But if not, then simply to die, and to live on in the memory of anything good I ever did for anyone, any good act, any act of kindness and love and—" "And what?" "I was going to say that I wanted to live on in memory for the acts I had done in praise of God. But I don't care about that now. I just want to die. I would rather God would leave me alone." I stood up. I looked down at him. "Did Cyrus tell you who I was in life? How he came to know me?"
"No, you can go read his letters for yourself. He said only that your strength was too great for any magician but myself, and that he owed you a great debt, that your death had been his doing."
He stopped, thinking, pulling on his beard.
"Of course, the king of all the world is not going to add to a letter that he was personally frightened of a spirit, and wishes to get it as far from him as possible. But there was that, shall we say, tinge to the letter. You know, 'I cannot command this spirit, I dare not, and yet I owe him my kingdom.'"
I can't remember his owing me anything. I remember asking to be sent. I remember...
"Yes?"
"Being forsaken by all."
"Well, these fools haven't made a demon. They have made something more like an angel."
"Angel of might," I said. "You use those words yourself. Cyrus used them. Marduk used them." I stopped, stumped by the name Marduk, and seeing nothing to surround the name or make it plausible in my speech.
"Marduk, the god of Babylon?" he asked.
"Don't mock him. He suffers," I said, amazing myself.
"You want vengeance on those who did this to you?"
I took it. I can't remember anyone else who is not dead. It was the priest's doing, and he... and the old woman, she died, the witch, the seer. I can't remember. I knew only Cyrus could help me, and I knew that I had a right to walk into his bedchamber, that I would make him listen to me. No, I don't want vengeance. No. I don't remember anything enough to want it, any more than I hanker after life. I don't. There is something I want. To die. To rest. To sleep. To be dead in the sweet-smelling earth. Or to see the light as I become one with it, one tiny spark of the light of God returned to his flame. I want death most, even more than the light, just the quiet of death.
"You want this now," he said. "You didn't want it when you went walking, or roaming the realm of the spirits, or bringing the scrolls for me, or when you first sat down in this garden and kept touching the grass with your hands."
"That's because you're a good man," I said.
"No, that's because you are a good man. Or were. and goodness burns as bright in you now as it ever did. Souls without memory are dangerous. You remember, but you remember only the good.
No, I've told you how much I hate them.
Yes, but they're gone. They're receding from you fast. You can't remember their names or their faces. You don't hate them, but you remember good. Last night you told me you found gold in your pockets. What did you do with it? You didn't say.
Well, I gave it to the poor and hungry, a family of them, so they could eat.
I reached out and gathered the loose grass that would come up from the cracks between the marble. I looked at the tender green shoots.
You're right. I do remember goodness, or I know it. I know it, and I see it, and I feel it.
Then I'll teach you everything I can, he said. We'll travel. We'll go to Athens and then down into Egypt. I have never been deep into Egypt. I want to go. We'll travel by magic, or sometimes merely in the natural way, because you're a strong guardian, and you must remember everything I teach you. Your tendency, your weakness, is to veer away from pain by forgetting it. And when I die, you'll feel some pain.
He fell quiet. I think the lessons were at an end for a little while. He closed his eyes. But I had a further pressing question.
Ask it, then, before I go to sleep.
These Canaanites, who made this curse, were they Hebrew?
Not really, he said. Not Hebrew as you are. Their Yahweh was one of many gods, only the strongest, a war god, it seems. They were ancient peoples, and they believed in other gods, too. Are you glad to hear this?
My mind had drifted. I suppose I am, I said. Yes, I am. But I belong to no tribe now. My destiny is to belong to the best of masters, for without them I may forget everything. I may drift. I may cease to see or hear or feel. And I won't be dead, merely waiting for the one who calls me forth.
I won't live long, he said. I'll teach you every trick I know that you have the power to do, and how to deceive men with illusions, and how to create spells over them with words and attitudes. That's all it is. Remember, words, attitudes. It's the abstract, not the particular. You could make a curse of a list of barrels of grain if you said it right, you know. But I'll teach you, and you will listen. And when I die?
Yes.
We'll see what the wide world teaches you by that time.
Don't expect too much of me, I said.
I looked at him directly, which I had rarely done in all this time.
You ask me what I remember. I remember killing the Bedouins, and I liked it very much. Not as much as the flowers, gathering them, you know, but killing. What is there like it on earth?
You have a point, he said. You have to learn that to love is better. To be kind is even better. In killing, you crush a universe of beliefs and feelings and generations in that one person whom you kill. But when you do kindness, it's like dropping a pebble in the great ocean, and the ripples go on forever and ever. And no wave, not even those as far away as Italy or Egypt, is the same. Kindness actually has considerably more power than killing has. But you'll come to see it. You knew it when you were alive.
He considered for a moment, and then concluded his advice for the day.
You see, it's a matter of how well you can measure these things. When you strike down a man, you don't see the full implications of his death. Not then. You feel the blood rush in you. Even as a spirit, you are formed in the likeness of man. But when you do something good, you can see it often. You can see it, and see it, and see it. And that's what overrides the desire to kill, finally. The goodness shines too bright. It's too undeniable. When you walked, you saw it in people's faces, didn't you? Goodness. No one tried to hurt you. Not even the palace guards. They let you by. Was it your clothing and your demeanor? Or did you smile at them as well? Did your face shine with goodwill? Each time you return to me, you are happy, and your spirit, whatever made it, has a great capacity to love. I didn't answer. What is in your head now? He asked. Tell me. The Bedouins, I said. What fun it was to kill them, I answered. You're stubborn, he said. He closed his eyes and went to sleep. I sat there watching, and gradually I slept too, asleep in my body, listening to the flowers next to my ears, and looking up into the branches of the olive tree now and then to see the birds there, and the distant sounds of the city became a music to me. And when I dreamed, it was of gardens, and light, and fruit trees, and joyous spirits with faces filled with love. Words were woven into my dreams. And I will give thee the treasures of darkness, and hidden riches of secret places, that thou mayest know that I, the Lord, which call thee by thy name, am the God of Israel. I form the light, and I create darkness. I make peace, and create evil. My eyes opened, but then I knew sweeter verses, and sank back into a half-sleep of song and willow trees swaying in the breeze. Chapter 13 For 15 years I traveled with Zervan. I did his bidding in all things. He was rich, as I've said, and many times he wanted to travel merely as men do. And we went by ship to Egypt, and then back again to Athens and to other cities which he had visited in his youth and had despaired of ever seeing again. Almost never did he let on that he was a magician, though now and then he was recognized by one with second sight. And when called upon to heal the sick, he would do what he could. In every place we traveled, he bought or had me borrow for him, or even steal, tablets and scrolls of magic. And these he studied and read to me and made me memorize, further reinforcing his conviction that all magic was more or less the same. That I can remember these years with crystal clarity is a mercy, because during the time that separated me from his death and the present, I have few distinct memories at all. I know there were times after Zervan's death when I woke with no memory and served my masters out of boredom, and sometimes watched them bring destruction upon themselves and thought it amusing, and even now and then took the bones from them myself to another. But all this is hazy, fog, meaningless. Zervan was right. My response to pain and to suffering was to forget. And it is the overall tendency of spirits to forget. Flesh and blood, bodily needs, these are what inspire memory in man. And when these are wholly absent, it can be sweet to remember nothing at all. During Zervan's life he made a better casket for the bones. He made it out of very strong wood, plated inside and out with gold. And he made a carved-out space for the bones to rest in their curled position, as that of a child asleep. He had carpenters work on this because, in truth, the work of his spirit familiars was not exact enough for him. Those who know the material world work with greater respect for it, he said. On the outside of this casket, which was a rectangle just long enough to contain my skeleton, he carved the name of what I was and how I was to be called, and he carved the stern warning that I must never be used for evil, lest that evil descend upon the one who calls. He cautioned against the destruction of my bones, lest all restraint upon me go with it. He wrote all this in the form of incantation and sacred poetry in many languages all over the casket. He put a Hebrew symbol or letter, which means life, on the casket. It was very good that he did all this early, because his death came quite by surprise. He died in his sleep, and I was called forth only when his house in Syracuse was being raided by petty thieves, and people of the village who knew he had no kin and were in no fear for him. And as he had left no demons to guard his body, they sacked the house, found the casket, spoke of the bones, and I awoke. I slew every one present, down to the smallest child who rummaged through Zervan's clothes. I slew them all. That night, the villagers came to burn the house of the Magus in hopes of dispelling its evil. I was glad of this because I knew that Zervan, being Greek by birth, though a man of no nation or tribe by choice, wanted his remains to be burnt, and I had arranged them within the house so that they burnt first and fast. I journeyed back to Miletus, and then on towards Babylon, though I didn't remember why. I grieved for Zervan. I thought only of Zervan. I was in pain night and day, invisible, in the flesh, frightened to go into the bones to rest, lest I never come out of them, and lugging my skeleton with me through the desert sands. At last I came to a city of Babylon, but found myself repelled by it, and hating it, and walking in pain with every step. I saw nothing that sparked a memory, only a feeling. I left very shortly after I'd come, and I went back to Athens, which had been the birthplace of Zervan. And finding a little house, I made a safe hiding-place for the bones, far, far beneath it, and then I went into them, and all was blackness. Much later, I awoke with faint memories of Zervan, yet remembering all his lessons. But it was another century, and maybe I always remembered his lessons. I think that may be the key to my eventual rebellion, that I remembered his lessons and loathed the perversion of them. Whatever the case, I was called forth in Athens. The soldiers of Philip II of Macedon had come down on Athens and beaten the Greeks, and Philip the Barbarian, as they called him, was looting the city, and in the process the bones were unearthed. When I came forth it was in the tent of a Macedonian magician, and he was as amazed to lay eyes on me as I was on him. I remember almost nothing of him. What I remember is the vibrant quality of the world, the lure of being solid once more, of tasting water, and of wanting to be a living and breathing thing, even if only an imitation. I knew also my great strength, kept the secret from this master, and only quietly obeyed his largely petty and foolish commands. He was a small magician. I was passed by him to another and another. My next distinct memory is only because Gregory Belkin wakened it in me, that I was in Babylon when Alexander the Great died. How I got there, whom I served, I don't remember. But I remember dressing myself, making my body into that of one of Alexander's soldiers, so that I might pass before his bed and see him signal with his hand that he was dying. I remember Alexander as he lay on his bed, that he burnt with an aura as bright as that of Cyrus the Persian. Even in dying he was very beautiful and strangely alert. He was observing himself die, and he was not fighting to live, not desperate to live. It was as if he knew this was to be the end of his life. I don't recall him knowing that a spirit had walked past him, as I was solid and very complete. I do recall going back to my master of the moment and telling him, yes, the conqueror of the world was dying, and it seems this master was old and Greek too, and that he wept. I recall that I put my arm around him to comfort him. I wouldn't remember that much if it weren't for Gregory crying out the name of Alexander with such fury in New York, and declaring that Alexander was the only man who had really ever changed the whole world. I could struggle now through other masters, bring up out of the cauldron of memory bits and pieces. But there is no dignity or magic or greatness that calls to me, that makes me long to recount it. I was an errand boy, a spirit sent to spy, to steal, sometimes even to kill. I remember killing. But I don't remember feeling remorse. I don't remember ever serving anyone whom I thought was unspeakably evil. And I do remember that I slew two masters at various times upon waking, because they were evil men. But this is hazy, as I said, unclear to me. What I remember next, and most vividly, what I remembered only weeks ago when I awoke in the cold, clear New York streets to witness the murder of Esther Belkin, what I remembered immediately with any clarity was the last master, Samuel of Strasbourg, named for the prophet, of course. Samuel was a leader and a magician among the Jews of Strasbourg. I only remember loving him and his 5 beautiful daughters, and I remember not the details of the beginning or the middle, but only the last days when the Black Death had come, when the city was in an uproar, and the word came down from the powerful Gentiles that all of us Jews should get out, because the local authorities might not be able to protect us from the mob. The last night shines before my eyes. Samuel was the only one left in the house. His 5 daughters had been smuggled out of Strasbourg to safety, and he and I sat in the main room of his house, a very rich house, I might add, and he made it known to me that no matter what I said or did, he would not flee the wrath of the mob. Many poor Jews could not escape what was about to happen, and Samuel, much to my amazement, had conceived of the notion that someone of his tribe or clan might need him at the end, and that he must remain. He had not always been so self-sacrificing by nature, yet he had chosen to remain. I was frantic, slamming my fists, ranging out and coming back to tell him that the entire neighborhood was surrounded, that the entire population of this district would shortly be burned. The history of the world was no mystery to me, and neither was Samuel. The substance of the man was vivid then and is now. I'd gotten gold for him in abundance. I had spied on his connections in business and banking. I had been the source of his immense and ever-increasing wealth. Killing, that was something I had never done for him, because he never thought of anything so crude. He was a merchant Jew, a banker Jew, and clever and beloved and respected by the Gentile community for his good rates of interest and his reasonableness when it came to the payment of debt. A kindly man? Yes, but a worldly man, though a bit mystical. And now he sat in this room, as the mob and the fire drew closer, as the city of Strasbourg turned into hell around us, and he quietly refused to leave. "There are ways out of this city still. I can take you," I said. Indeed, we both knew of tunnels beneath the house of the Jewish district which led to the world outside the walls. They were old, true, but we knew them. I could have taken him through them. Or upwards, with great power, invisible through the air. "Master, what will you do? Let them kill you? Tear you limb from limb? Either the fire will come racing at you from both ends of the street outside, or they will come to tear off your rings and your robes before they kill you. Master, why are you choosing to die?" He had told me 12 times to be quiet and go back into the bones. I wouldn't do it. Finally I said, "I won't let this happen to you. I'll take you from here, you and the bones." "Azrael," he cried, "there is time and you will be still." He neatly put aside the last of his books, a volume of his cherished Talmud, and his books of the Kabbalah from which had come much of his magic, and then he waited, with his eye on the door. "Master," I asked, "my memory of this is exquisite. Master, what of me? What will happen? Will the bones be found without their casket? Where do I go, Master?" Surely I had never asked such a self-serving question, because the look of surprise on his face was so bright. He broke off his reverie and staring at the door, and he looked up at me. "Master, when you die, can you take my spirit with you?" I said. "Can you take your loyal servant into the light?" "Oh, Azrael," he said in the most despairing voice, "whatever gave you such notions, foolish, foolish spirit? What do you think you are?" The tone of his voice infuriated me. The look on his face infuriated me. "Master, you're leaving me to the ashes, to the looters," I cried out. "Can't you clasp my hand as they kill you, if that's what you must have? Can't you take my hand and take me with you? 30 years I've served you, made you rich, made your daughters rich. Master, you're leaving me here. The casket may burn. The bones may burn. What will happen?" He looked completely confused. He looked ashamed. At that point the door of the house opened, and two very finely dressed Gentile merchant bankers whom I knew came into the room. Both were anxious. "We have to hurry, Samuel," they said. "They're starting the fires near the walls. They're killing the Jews everywhere. We cannot help you escape." "Did I ask you to?" said Samuel with contempt. "Give me the proof that my daughters are away." Anxiously, they put a letter in his hand. I saw it was from one of many moneylenders whom he trusted most, who was in Italy and in a safe place, and it confirmed that his daughters had come and described the color of the dress of each and every one, and her hair, and gave the special word from her which her father demanded. The Gentiles were terrified. "We must hurry, Samuel. If you're determined to die here, keep your word. Where is the casket?" At these words I was astonished. Only too quickly did I understand. I had been bartered for the salvation of the five daughters. Neither of these men could see me, but they saw the casket of my bones, which was in plain sight with the books of the Kabbalah. And they went to the casket and opened it, and there lay my bones. "Master," I said in a secret voice to him, "you can't give me to these men. These men are Gentiles. They aren't magicians. They're not great men." Samuel was amazed still, staring at me. "Great? When did I ever tell you I was great, or even good, Azrael? When did you ever ask?" "In the name of the Lord God of hosts," I said, "I did for you what was good for you and your family and your elders and your synagogue. Samuel, what do you do to me now?" The two Gentiles closed the casket. "Goodbye, Samuel," they said, as one of them hugged the casket to his breast, and they both hurried out the door. I could see the light of the fire. I could smell it. I could hear people screaming. "You evil, evil man!" I cursed him. "You think God will forgive you because this fire cleanses you, and you've sold me for money, for gold!" "For my daughters, Azrael, spirit, you have found a powerful voice too near the end." "The end of what?" But I knew. I could feel already the others calling, those who had their hands on the bones. They were already outside the city gates. And my hatred and contempt was boiling in me. Their calls were a temptation. I came at Samuel. "No, spirit," he declared. "Obey me. Go to the bones. Obey as you always have. Leave me to my martyrdom." There came the call again. I couldn't hold my form. I was too angry. My body was dissolving. I had in my anger forfeited too much. The voices that called me were strong. They were farther and farther away, but nonetheless strong. I lunged at Samuel, and I threw him out the open door. The street was full of flames. "There's your martyrdom, Rabbi," I shouted. "I curse you to walk among the undead for all your existence, until God forgives you for what you did to me, leaving me, bartering with me, leading me to love you, and selling me like gold." From both directions, terrified people ran to him, people who were suffering their final anguish. "Samuel! Samuel!" they cried out his name. My bitterness broke for an instant when I saw him embrace them. "Samuel!" I cried. I came towards him. I was growing weak, but I was still visible to him. "Take my hand. Hold the hand of my spirit, please, Samuel. Take me with you into death." He didn't speak. The crowd surrounded him, sobbing and clinging to him. But I heard his last thought as he rebuffed me, as he turned his eyes away. He said as clearly as if aloud, "No, spirit, because if I die with my hand in yours, you may take me down into hell." I cursed him. "Not enough grace and goodness for both of us, Master! Master! Leader! Teacher! Rabbi!" The flames engulfed the crowd. I rose upwards through the flame and smoke, and felt the cold night pass through me, and I sped towards the sanctuary of the bones. I sped away from smoke and horror and injustice and the screams of the innocent. I went through the dark woods, as a witch to a Sabbath, flying with my arms out. And then I saw the two Gentiles at the door of a small church at a great remove from the city. the casket on the ground between them, and wanting only death and silence, I relaxed into the bones. All I learnt of them was that they were weeping for Strasbourg, for the Jews, for Samuel, for the whole tragedy, and that they planned to sell me in Egypt. They were not magicians. I was a marketable prize. It didn't seem that mine was a long, uninterrupted sleep. I was called. I was taken places. I slew those who called me, and some I can picture, some not. The history of the world was written on the blank and endless tablets of my mind in column after column. I did not think, however. I slept. Once a Mameluke in beautiful silk called me forth. It was Cairo, and I chopped him to pieces with his own sword. It took all the wise men of the palace to drive me back into the bones. I remember their beautiful turbans and their frantic cries. They were such a flashy lot, those Moslem soldiers, those strange men who lived all their lives without women, and only to fight and to kill. Why didn't they destroy me? Because of the inscriptions that warned them against a masterless spirit who could seek revenge. I recall in Paris a clever satanic magician in a room full of gaslight. The wallpaper was most intriguing to me. A strange black coat hung on a hook. Life almost tempted me. Gaslight and machines, carriages rolling on cobbled streets. But I killed the mysterious man and retreated once more into the bones. It was always that way. I slept. I think I remember a winter in Poland. I think I remember an argument between two learned men. But all this is misty and imperfect. They spoke a Hebrew dialect, and they had called me, but neither seemed to know I was there. They were good and gentle men. We were in a plain synagogue, and they argued. And then they decided that my bones must be hidden within the wall. Good men. I slept. When I came to life again, it was in the bright winter sunlight only weeks ago, as a trio of assassins made their way through the press on Fifth Avenue to kill Esther Belkin as she came out of her black limousine and entered the store before her. Innocent, beautiful, without the slightest sense of death circling her. And why was I there? Who had called me? I knew only these assassins meant to kill her, these hideous, rustic, evil men, drugged and stupid and enchanted with the pleasure of killing her, in all her innocence. I had to stop it. I had to. But I was too late. You know what the papers told you. Who was this innocent child? She saw me, spoke my name. How had she known me? She had never called me. She had only seen me in the thin realm between life and death, where truths are visible which are otherwise veiled. Let us linger on this killing. A death such as Esther's deserves a few more words. Or maybe I need to recount my coming into awareness. Maybe I need to describe what it was like to see and breathe again in this mighty city, with towers higher than the mystical mountains of Meru, among thousands of people, good and bad, and without luster, as Esther was being marked for the kill. Part 3. How Keep Dark and Pattern Off. From Some Lamb, by Stan Rice, 1975. How keep dark and pattern that any man suffers off, at the wall, at where the hat comes out of the marrow and yawns? How keep head up the scream and up the burial where the pattern is born? How the leagues washing their hearts and wrung dry only to sponge back up, men smooching mirrors, blades honing, tongue and eyelash of sweet thing staggering the shape by the door in the baggy shadow? How keep dark back? Or should one bullet forth, sleek clothed or naked, pierce each entity, each clock, sharpened by art or wine, How enter the needle, the cloth? How take the pattern any man suffers, and lose nothing when you rip it off?
Chapter 14. Follow me now, if you will, into consciousness. Evils in the bright winter light of day. See how they shine. That's how I first knew them. This was a joke to them, because evil was their word for bad. And their names were Evil, E-V-A-L. Three brothers out of Texas hired to kill the rich girl. Down the crowded avenue, in a bath of noonday sun they walked, jostling each other, laughing, passing the cigarette, bold and hot for the kill. How they loved to look at themselves in the mirrors of shops. And this was New York, the biggest city in the world, the only city these evils cared about, except for Las Vegas, where they will go with their earnings after they've taken her out, which in their vernacular meant kill her. They weren't never going back to Texas. Who knew what jobs the man might have for them? But first they had to kill her dead. I could feel their easy malice, even as purely as they felt it. Billy Joel Evil in the lead, with the gun in his pocket, and also the long, sharp pick. Such a cruel pick with a rounded blade of steel. And Dobie Evil right behind, with Hayden Evil sucking hind tit, they taunted him. And all of them had those sharp weapons, long picks made of steel, oh, so ready to kill her. But who was she? There had to be a reason for my seeing this. There had to be a reason that I stood in the city of New York, breathing in the smells of New York as if I were alive and visible, when I was neither, only knowing what a genii always knows, that he has been called again to duty, that once again his eyes and his mind have opened on a blazing and vital world. You know how rebellious I was, I've told you, how indifferent, how perfectly willing to cut to pieces a despicable master. But what was happening here? Loathing these rustic monsters was easy enough. I walked right by them. I saw them up close in their city drab disguise, in quilted jackets of nylon and ragged cotton pants, machine-made shoes full of nails and hooks for the strings. Billy Joel couldn't wait to see her, couldn't wait to get close to her. And only Hayden held back, scared to tell his brother he didn't like it so much, killing this girl. If only they had known who paid them. Who had paid them? A man through a man through a man, said Dobie Evil, as if you can't figure that out. Suddenly I felt my feet hit the pavement. But I was too transparent for anyone else to see, gathering slowly, trailing them, coming up so close on them now that they might have looked back and seen me, if anyone could. And I wasn't sure anyone could. Who is commanding me? I whispered. I felt my lips move. The crowd was as thick on this city street as any I'd ever beheld, and the wealth was closing in around me as if this were the marketplace of Babylon on the New Year, or the bazaars of Baghdad or Istanbul. Through plate glass I saw the faceless, white, plastic goddesses of fashion, in their magnificent fringe and fur, shine of true rubies, magical slippers made of thin steel straps to bind the foot fetchingly. And all this with no explanation. Well, you know me well enough by now, the sensualist I am. Hand me the world in a cup, and I'll drink it. But this killing of the girl, this had to be stopped. I closed in on them, walked among them, but still they couldn't see me, though I was feeling the shape of my body, the heat of it, the growing density. Yes, I was here all right. This was no garbled, hideous phantasm in the wind. There came the heat of the sidewalk beneath me, and something like the thud of my own feet in leather shoes, just make them plain like theirs. I knew the stench came from the engines in the street, and when I looked up, I saw the towers reaching the noonday clouds, yet lights blazing everywhere, in windows, behind written signs, all fueled by electricity. What a modern world this was, teeming with the rich. What a city this was, with the humpbacked dwarf and the cripple lurching past me, both wearing fine clothes and gold, and the screeching woman on the corner, long gone mad, ripped open a blouse of pure silk to show her breasts.
Someone pushed her off the curb. Hordes of young men in severe dark suits, each with a tie at the neck of his shirt, walked fast and with purpose, though obviously all disconnected, separate, not even glancing at one another. The evils laughed.
"Oh, I'm telling you, this is one hell of a place, this New York. I'm telling you, just look at her. Did you see that?
Now, you know this broad we're taking out. She's not crazy like that, no way. Now, you do what I said."
"Do what you said," cursed the brother Hayden.
I was neck and neck with them. I could smell their sweat and the cheap soap they had used to wash half of it away. And I could smell their guns. But that wasn't the way, the gun, the bullet, the explosion. I tried to learn it all as quickly as I could. They would use the sharp-pointed picks that each carried under his clothes. "Why do you do this to her?" I must have spoken aloud because Billy Joel stopped, right shoulder jerking up, mouth pulled down on the ends as he stared at Hayden, and then told him,
"Will you shut up, you son of a bitch? Come on now, I'm telling you, we couldn't have gotten out of here any way but this way."
"Sure, and we do her, and then we just run like little kids, just run," said Hayden, shoving his brother with his left hand in the middle of the back. So the brother Billy Joel said,
"You lay off. Look, you son of a bitch, you see it? You see it, Doby? She's in that goddamn car. That's her car. Look at that car."
The three came together, and I fell back, invisible still, but totally formed, or perhaps I should say conformed, to the look of men around me. I wanted to see her, this girl they meant to kill with their evil picks, as they ambled and danced now, letting the crowd stream past them, nudging each other to stop. There she was. The time had come. "Look. See the long black limousine by the curb, and the driver with his white hair opening the door for her? Esther. Hair a mantle of dark curls, jet-black hair, as black as mine, and her eyes larger, and the whites of them were so shiny they looked as if they were made of pearls, and her long white throat bare to the swell of her breasts beneath a painted coat. A coat painted with the stripes of an animal, not to look like the animal itself, but to look like the painted stripes of one. She didn't even notice them, these three common and visible terrors who were going to take her out. The crowd shifted and broke to make an uneven path for her. "What am I to do?" I whispered. "Stop this? Why is she to die for what?" I didn't want to witness it. She pushed wide the glass doors of the shop and passed inside, with the throng so thick that 5 people must have followed her before the evils made their way in, and now they knew they were in trouble.
"Jesus, do we have to do it in here?"
By that Hayden meant that this was a palace of goods, a treasure house of furs and veils, of leathers dyed in all colors, and perfume rising from the glass tables as if from altars. They didn't look so ordinary in here, these slithering, swaggering, bucolic men. No, rather like tramps from a waterfront, crawling out from under the rope with the rats to steal what men have dropped. But it was so crowded, even here, shoulder to shoulder, and cheek turned from cheek, as lashes rose and fell to make the eye private. And the noise was loud. No one took the proper notice, 3 clothed in filth, tracking the beautiful woman. And she, the young queen with the dark shining hair and the painted coat, came up the steps to the landing, her face innocent and bright as she reached for a long black scarf, a beaded scarf, a lovely twinkling thing, and caught it in her fingers, dangling from the hook, a scarf full of dark stitched flowers and shimmering embroidered designs, lovely, as if meant for her.
"Good afternoon, Miss Belkin."
So the queen had a name, and the merchants of this time were no less clever than in any other. But I saw Billy Joel had struck. In that 1 second he had pushed against her slender back. Hayden took her from the left, and Doby, as frenzied as Billy Joel, drove his pick from the right, so that the 3 wounds were made at once, and the life inside her lurched, and the language in her died, but not her heart. Her lungs filled with blood. Geniuses of the kill, these cheap assassins. They walked right away from her, before she even fell, not even bothering to run, out of the door before she even tottered over the glass case. The scarf was still in her right hand. The woman bent over.
"Miss Belkin?"
I had to follow them.
She was falling down dead, leaning over the glass, as if this was just a pain she had to feel and it would pass. She'd be dead in seconds. And I knew the killers, and the merchant lady didn't even know she was dying. I shot through the front doors. I knew I shoved against the humans to move them out of my way. I felt them. I wasn't going to lose the evils. I went up. Over the heads of the crowd I flew, formed but transparent. Nothing anyone would notice, and quickly caught up with them. The evils had broken apart, but no one in this next block of shuffling hundreds seemed to notice them. What need was there to hurry? Billy Joel had a smile on his face, bright smile. They had put 300 people and 10 seconds between them and the murder. "I will kill you for this," I heard my voice aloud. I felt the air inside me swirling, as if I'd made myself solid enough to feed on the fumes that rose from the pavements, from the stalled engines, from the blasting horns, from the swarm of human flesh. "Come to me, garments like those of my enemy, as I am made flesh!" I dropped down in front of Billy Joel. "Reach for the pick. Get it. Kill him." I saw my fingers close on his wrist. He never clearly saw me, only felt the bone break. As he cried out, his brother turned. I drove the pick into Billy Joel. I took its wooden handle out of his belt and drove it in through his shirt, deep, the way he had driven it into her, only many more times. Astonished, he spurted blood. "You die, you filthy dog. You killed that girl. You die." Hayden came towards me, right onto the pick, no trouble at all, and I gave him 3 quick thrusts, including one in the neck. There were people walking by, not turning their heads. Others were looking at the fallen Billy Joel. Now only Dobie was left, and Dobie had fled. Dobie had seen them go down and was running about as fast as a human can run through the obstacle course of the crowd. I reached out, grabbed his shoulder. "Wait a minute, man," he said to me. I sank the pick into his chest, the same 3 times, to make it good, and pushed him towards the wall. People stepped out of our way, turning the other way. He slid down to the pavement dead, and a woman cursed as she stepped over his left leg. Now I understood the genius of their crime in this crowded city. But there was no time to think on it. I had to return to Esther. My body was formed. I was running. And I had to make my way, like any other human now, solid, back to the glass doors of the palace. The air was filled with screams. Men ran into the emporium of clothes. I pushed to get close. I could feel my tangled black hair. I could feel my beard. All eyes were on her. Out she came, laid and covered on a white linen stretcher. I saw her head tumbled to my side, her big glossy eyes, with their pearly whites so pure, her mouth leaking blood like an old fountain, just a trickle. Men screamed for others to get back. An old one wailed at the top of his lungs, bowing as he saw her. This was her driver, her guard perhaps, the gray-haired man. His face was furrowed, his narrow back bent. He bowed and cried out. He cried out in a dialect of Hebrew. He loved her. I pushed carefully towards her. A white car came speeding to the spot, printed with red crosses and topped by swirling lights. The sirens were unspeakable. Might as well have been the picks through my ears. But there was no time to worry about my pain. She was still living, breathing. I had to tell her. Into that car they carried her, lifted high, like an offering over the crowd. Through the back doors she went inside, her eyes looking for something, for someone. Gathering all my strength, I moved others out of my path. My hands, true and familiar and mine, hit the long glass-windowed side of the white car. I looked into the glass. I felt my nose against it. I saw her. Her big, sleepy eyes full of dreamy death. I saw her. And she said aloud, I heard it, a whisper rising like a whiff of smoke. "The servant. Azrael. The servant of the bones." The door was open. The men ministering to her bent low. "What is it, honey? What did you say?" "Don't make her speak." She stared at me through the glass, and she said it again. I saw her lips move. I heard her voice. I heard her thought. Azrael, she whispered. The servant of the bones.
They're dead, my darling, I cried out. No one around me, pressing as hard as I pressed to see her, cared what I said. She and I, we looked at each other. Then her soul and spirit blazed for one instant, visible and together, the full shape of her body over her, hair like wings, face expressionless or turned away from the earth forever. Who can know? And then she was gone, risen in a blinding light. I ducked from the light, then tried to see it again. But it was gone. The body lay an empty sack. The doors slammed shut. The siren split my ears again. The car roared into the stream, forcing other engines out of its path. People shifted and sighed and groaned around me. I stood stock still on the pavement. Her soul was gone. I looked up. Knees pushed against my leg. A foot came down hard upon my own. I wore the same kind of dirty string shoe as my enemy. I was almost toppled from the shallow curb. The car was beyond my sight, and the evil's dead not 100 feet away, yet no one here in this melee knew, so crowded was it. And I thought, without context, without reason, of what was said about Babylon after Cyrus conquered it, that funny remark which the Greek historian Xenophon had made. Or was it Herodotus? That so big was Babylon, and so dense with people, that it took 2 whole days before people in the middle of the city knew that it had been taken at all. Well, not me. A man said, "Did you know who that was?" This was English, New York talk. And I turned just as if I were alive and I were going to answer, only there were tears in my eyes. I wanted to say, "They killed her." Nothing came out of my mouth, but I had a mouth, and the man was nodding as if he saw the tears. My God, help me. This man wanted to comfort me. Someone else spoke. "That was Gregory Belkin's daughter, that's who that was," the man said. "That was Esther Belkin." "Belkin's daughter? Temple of the Mind." "Temple of the Mind of God, Belkin." What did these words mean to me? "Master, where are you? Name yourself, or show yourself. Who has called me? Why have I been made to witness this?" "Gregory Belkin's little girl, the Minders." "Which way?" I began to fade. I felt it swift and terrible as it always is, as surely as if the Master had commanded all the artificial and gathered particles of me, as it is written, "Return now to your place." Just for a moment I clung to the storm of matter, commanding it to sheathe me, but my cry was a wail. I stared down at my hands, my feet, such filthy shoes, cloth and string and leather shoes, slippers more than shoes, shoes on the pavement. "Azrael, stay alive," came the voice from my mouth. "Take it easy, son," said the man beside me. And he looked at me as if he felt sorry for me. He lifted his arm to embrace me. I put my hand up. I saw the tears. But the wind had come, the wind that comes for all spirits. I was losing my hold. The man was looking for me, and he couldn't find me, and he didn't know why, and thought it was his own confusion. Then he and all those with him, and the great city, was gone too. I was nothing now. Nothing. I struggled to see the crowd below, but I couldn't find the spots where the evils lay dead in their blood still, or were being taken away with such care as the queen with her dark hair, the goddess who had died seeing me. She had said it. I heard it. She had said, "Azrael, the servant of the bones." I had heard her as a spirit hears, though the man in the car with her might not hear something so small and tragic as her whisper. The wind took me. The wind was filled with the wail of the souls, faces bearing down upon me, hands seeking to grip me, and turning my back on it as always I let go. I saw the last dim outline of my hands for one instant. I felt the form of arms and legs. I felt the tears on my face. Yes, I felt that. Then I was a goner. Into the bones, Azrael. I was safe. So there you have the picture. Masterless, risen to witness this. To avenge it? Why? The darkness overcame me like a drug. Safe, yes, but I didn't want to be safe.
I wanted to find the man who had sent those evils to kill her.
Chapter 15. Time passed. I felt it more intensely than usual. I knew that I was listening. I was there. I knew what the world was now, more or less, as always. Bear with me. I knew what men and women knew, those whom I'd seen and touched in the New York street. The particulars made a moral impression. Emotion gradually accompanied the synthesis of knowledge. Ghosts don't have to interpret. Ghosts don't have to be amazed or shocked. But the mind of the ghost, unfettered by flesh, can gather to itself indiscriminately and perhaps infinitely the sum of what is shared or valued by nearby human minds. Awake once more in the darkness, I grasped the general and the spectacular, that we were nearing the end of the 20th century of what men call the common era, that fossil fuel and generated electricity were indispensable to the everyday methods of eating, drinking, sleeping, communicating, traveling, building, and fighting, that micro-machines of exquisite circuitry could store information in abundance, and that vivid moving pictures in which people appeared and spoke could be transmitted by waves or over tiny delicate fibers more precious than spun glass. Waves. The air was full of waves, full of voices speaking both privately and publicly, from telephones, through radios, televisions. The world was as fully surrounded by voices now as it was by air itself. And the earth was indeed round. Not a mile of it remained uncharted, unowned, or unnamed. No part of it lay beyond communication, because the mysterious waves of telephones, radios, and televisions could be bounced off satellites in space and back to Earth again at any locale. Sometimes the television pictures and voices were of people and actions taking place at the very moment they were being transmitted, known as live TV. Chemistry had reached unprecedented heights, achieving through extraction, purification, analysis, and new combinations all manner of new substances, materials, drugs. The very process of combining had been transformed so that there was now physical change, chemical change, chain reaction, chemical reaction, and fusion, to name but a few. Materials had been broken down and made into new materials, and the process was without limit. Science had surpassed the alchemists' dreams. Diamonds had found their way into the bits of drills, yet people still wore them as ornaments, and they commanded millions of dollars, which was apparently a preferred currency, American dollars, though the world was full of currencies and languages, and people from Hong Kong spoke to people in New York merely by pressing a few buttons. The catalogue of synthetic materials and subsequent products had evolved beyond the memory or understanding of the common man, so that almost nobody could define for you the ingredients of the nylon shirt he wore, or the plastic calculator in his pocket. Of course, some conclusions, even for me, were inevitable. A car or plane dependent on the combustion of fossil fuel can explode rather than move forward. Bombs can be sent without pilots from one country to another to destroy even the biggest cities with the highest buildings. Hardly anywhere in the world did the sea not taste just a little of gasoline. New York was very far north of the equator, that was obvious, and one could say it was the capital in this time in the Western world. The Western world. This is where I have found myself. And what is the Western world? Apparently, the Western world was the direct cultural legacy of the Hellenism of Alexander the Great, its concepts of justice and purity infinitely amplified and complicated, but never really subverted by Christianity of varying kinds, from crude, screaming, mystic acceptance of Jesus, to dense theological sects which still argue over the nature of the Trinity, that is, whether or not there are three persons in one God. Scarcely a single part of the Western world had not been enriched and invigorated by an immensely creative and relentlessly spiritual Judaism. Jewish scientists, philosophers, doctors, merchants, and musicians were among the most celebrated of the era. The drive to excel was taken for granted, as it was in Babylon, even by those in despair. Natural law and law arrived at by reason had become common values. Revealed law and inherited law, on the other hand, had become suspect and subjected to argument. And all human lives now were created equal. That is, the life of a worker in the fields was as precious as the life of the titular Queen of England, or her elected Prime Minister. Technically, legally, there were no slaves. Few were certain as to the meaning of life, as few today as there had been in those times when I was alive. Once in the scriptorium, as a human boy, I had read in Sumerian the lament, "Who has ever known the will of heaven?" Any man or woman in the streets of New York today might have spoken the same words. This Western world, this legacy of Hellenism, infused with ever-evolving Judaism and Christianity, had flourished most dramatically in northern climes of the planet, both in Europe and in America, harnessing somehow the tenacity and the ferocity of those taller, shaggier, and often fairer dwellers of the woodlands and the steppes, who did not learn to be humans in Eden, but rather in lands where summer was always followed by the brutality of cold and snow. All the Western world, including its most tropical outposts, lived now as if winter might at any moment descend, isolate, even destroy. From towns near the northern polar ice cap all the way down to the tip of the jungles in Peru, people thrived in enclaves designed and sustained by machine, microchip, and microbiology, surrounded by surpluses of energy, fuel, finery, and food. Nobody ever wanted to run out of anything ever again, and this included information. Storage, archives, information banks, hard disk, floppy disk, backup tape, hard copy. Everything worth anything was somehow duplicated in one form or another and stored. It was basically the same theory that had created the archives of tablets in Babylon, which I had once studied. Not difficult to understand. But in spite of all these dazzling advances, amid which Esther Belkin had somehow drawn me to her like a magnet, and seemed even now to draw my consciousness to her, there existed still the old world. Follow the stream into the marshes, into the mountains, into the desert. The East was what they called it, or the Third World, or the undeveloped countries, or the backward countries, or the primitive areas. And it covered continents still where the Bedouin in timeless white garments walked his camel through the sandstorm, happy as ever to live amid sunbright desolation. Only now he might carry with him a battery-operated television set, and a can of a fire-making chemical called Sterno, so that when he pitched his tent, he could listen to the Koran read over the television, as his food was heated without the use of wood or coal. In the rice paddies, in the fields of India, in the marshes of Iraq, in the villages the world over, men and women stooped to gather the crop as they had since the dawn of time. Huge modern urban outposts had arisen amid the millions of Asia. Yet the vast majority of tribes, farmers, weavers, vendors, mothers, priests, beggars, and children, remained beyond the reach of Western invention, abundance, medicine, and sanitation. Sanitation was key. Sanitation involved the chemical purification of human waste and industrial waste, the purification of drinking water and water for bathing, the nullification of filth in all forms, and the maintenance of an environment in which one could be born, give birth, grow up, and die, in maximum security against human or industrial or chemical contamination of any kind. Nothing mattered as much as sanitation. Plagues had vanished from the earth due to sanitation. In the West, sanitation was taken for granted. In the East, sanitation was viewed with suspicion, or people were simply too numerous to be made to conform to the inevitable habits required by it. Disease was rampant in the jungles, in the marshes, in the deep pockets of vast cities, or in the wilderness where the peasants, the workers, the fellaheen, still lived as they always had. Hunger. There was plenty, and there was hunger. There was food thrown away in the streets of New York, and there were those starving in Asia on television programs.
It was a matter of distribution. Indeed, that there was as much organization amid all of this change was the modern mystery. That so much could happen, and that so much could remain the same. Everywhere were dramatic contrasts which could both confuse and delight the eye. The holy men of India walked naked beside the roaring automobiles in the teeming streets of Calcutta. People in Haiti lay on the ground starving to death as they watched planes fly overhead. The River Nile flowed into the metropolis of Cairo, where the buildings of steel and glass stand as high as in Manhattan. Yet the streets were thronged by men and women in loose, airy cotton robes of white or black, as pure as the garments worn by the Israelites when Pharaoh let the people go. The pyramids of Giza remained as always. Only the air surrounding them was thick with the emission of automobiles, and the modern city crawled almost to their feet. Within a stone's throw of air-conditioned office buildings, there lingered pockets of jungle where men knew nothing of Yahweh, Allah, Jesus, or Shiva, or of iron, copper, gold, or bronze. They hunted with wooden spears and poison from reptiles, only now and then stupefied by the sight of big mechanical bulldozers mowing down the forest which was their world. A flock of goats in the mountains of Judea still looked exactly like a flock of goats in the time of Cyrus the Persian. Shepherds tending sheep outside the city of Bethlehem looked exactly as they had when Jeremiah the prophet raved. Though east and west communicated and interacted continuously, each somehow held out against the other. Desert sheiks, rich from the oil discovered beneath their sands, still wore their headdress and robes as they drove about in automobiles. Vast numbers of the world's women still lived indoors almost entirely, and only entered a public street if their faces were veiled. In New York City, capital of the West and city of choice of the more clever and more powerful, the common person was utterly confident and utterly ignorant of science at the same time. What individual anywhere in the world knew the real meaning of binary code, semiconductor, triodes, electrolyte, or laser beam? In the upper echelons, a technological elite with the powers of a priesthood dealt in perfect faith with the invisible. Ions, neutrinos, gamma rays, ultraviolet light, and black holes in space. Icons shone bright for me in my awakening, bright as the eyes of Esther when she died. "Servant of the bones, listen," she might as well have said. "Servant of the bones, come, see." All the material world was mine to behold, to know, without haste or alarm as I slumbered, grieving for her, and angry, angry with her killers. In invisibility and silence I saw a man parked at 56th and 5th, speaking on a tiny phone in his car, in the German language, to an employee of his in the city of Vienna. One woman in a building in the city of Atlanta, in the country of America, talked for 24 hours before a camera about the weather all over the globe. Esther Belkin, my lost one, was mourned by thousands who had never known her. Her story broadcast to every country which could receive the cable news network, or as it was mostly known, CNN. Members of the International Temple of the Mind of God,